It's a pleasure to welcome to the studio George Dyson, who's written a number of books, and perhaps you're even planning to be at the Louisville Free Public Library tonight at 7 o'clock to see him in person talk about Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe. It is his latest book, and it tells the story of the development of the digital computer from its earliest days, coming out of a lot of military research. I think we'll even step back a little bit further than that, from the Second World War. Some of the principal characters, including a Louisvillian or two in this story, up to the present day and then beyond, stepping into what will be, what we think may be the future of digital computing. George Dyson is here. And first of all, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I said to you, as we were just getting ready to start this conversation, that I thought the book was very beautifully and lyrically written. And I wanted to ask you, if, certainly some of that is in your own style of writing, but for a story that is so, to be reductionist for a moment, left brain, you took a right brain way to tell it.
Yes, I think that's the interesting part. I mean, who were the people who made this sort of abstract idea real in the midst of their real lives, sort of in the aftermath of World War II? So that was a very interesting time. It wasn't, they didn't have to go very far to find interesting stories. It was sort of hard to stay away from them.
Let's go back to the 1940s then, and the development of this computer. There were some efforts to create a computer before that, digital computer at Iowa State University back in the 30s. ENIAC came later. But this moment where it was largely driven by the U.S. military and by the Defense Department, wasn't it?
Yes, it was really driven by two things. And I'm not at all speaking about the first computer, which we may never decide. And I think if you read the book carefully, there are 11 other computers that were first before the one that's the main sort of lead character in the book happens to be a machine. And what happened essentially was that a lot of computation was done in World War II on all sides, on what we consider the enemy side, on our side, which was British and American. But by the nature of the war, these projects were done in secret. So after the war, suddenly things open up. And that's why one reason it seems to move so quickly, because these ideas that had been developed secretly suddenly come out in the open.
And so this talk a little bit more about this idea. Obviously, you know, I think many of us have heard the story about the effort to coordinate, I think it was trajectories of firing missiles, trying to figure out how to, you know, get them to land where we wanted them to.
Right, and even harder was how to hit a moving airplane. So you're trying to hit a fast moving target. So you have these very difficult sort of prediction and timing problems. So the three main problems were breaking enemy codes, which was done best in England by the group at Bletchley Park, and then the anti-aircraft fire control, and then in America we. Again, led here, but also a lot of work in Britain on doing the computation to develop nuclear weapons, and particularly towards the end of the war, the hydrogen bomb. And that's really what drove the effort on this side.
How did this technology, which was being used for secret purposes, become available for more general use?
Well, that goes back to Turing, who's gets the title credit in the book, because it was Alan Turing, who was a precocious young British mathematician. At 23 years of age, he's trying to actually prove a sort of very obscure mathematical problem called the Entscheidungsproblem. And in solving this problem, he just sort of out of the blue, out of thin air, invents the idea of a universal machine, a computer that can compute anything that is computable. And the sort of perversity of it, as only a sort of a mathematician would think of this, he uses that to prove that even if you have a machine that can do anything, there are certain things mathematically that the machine cannot do. And it seemed to have no practical implication at the time, but very quickly it did. So if you built one computer, you could then do anything that was computable. So the question became how to make them faster, but not really change them.
The Defense Department could have held on to this technology and tried to prevent it from being used outside of the Defense Department, or could have considered it to be something that was classified and a military secret, the technology itself, But that didn't happen.
Yes. Well, it was classified till the end of the war. Mm-hmm. And then it was impossible to keep this secret. I mean, sort of mathematicians are probably the most talkative people in the world. The Russian mathematicians speak to, you know, English mathematicians speak to American mathematicians, speak to French mathematicians. So this was sort of in the fabric of mathematics. And, you know, how to do it could be kept secret, but the principle couldn't. And I think it's a tremendous credit to the American side and the British as well that this was opened up, you know, to the real world as quickly as it was, whereas, of course, nuclear weapons were kept secret.
You said something very early in the book, and I don't know why this is something I think about a lot, but it's something I wrote down at the time I was reading, and that it was that the digital computer was born in an analog age. And I guess what strikes me about that is the revolutionary step forward and what that presented, but it was an entirely different way of looking at the world. It was perhaps not the first time that we looked at the world in a binary way, but this was a very important step, and it was a change.
It was a big change, and the change was to do it at, you know, completely electronic speeds. We had a large punch card digital processing industry already, but that was electromechanical, and then we had relay computers. And to make this all work at the speed of light was the big breakthrough. And that's no accident that came out of the war, because we had, for radar, for the thing called identification, friend or foe, where airplane is not what you would think, but you actually want your airplane to be visible to the enemy, because you would much rather be shot down by the enemy than shot down by your friends. So we developed this pulse coded technology for that, which really went right into the computer business at the beginning.
Alan Turing, his life was cut short. Who were the other the principal players who pushed this new technology forward?
There were a number of them, and some are well known, and many are known very little, if at all. I mean, Alan Turing's one of his closest collaborators was Max Newman, who came over to, Turing himself was in New Jersey for a couple of years, and Max Newman came over. And at the time, there was very strong collaboration between all these different groups who were collaborating in the war effort. There was a very strong group at RCA who likewise don't get much credit for putting in solving many of the original problems and memory problems and things like that. There was Vladimir Zvorikin, who was Russian, was at RCA. So people from essentially every country, and driven to a large extent by the people who escaped from Europe, the ones who escaped the disaster in Europe that led to some of the smartest and most technically proficient people coming over to this side.
Why did it happen on this side? Why did it happen in the United States?
It didn't really. I mean, essentially, it happened in England, but the Americans got the credit. I mean, that's sort of maybe a little too brutally honest, but a large number of the ideas did come from the British side. The Americans were getting nowhere with their memory. It was stalled, and just classic computer thing. It wasn't being delivered, and so they went over to England and got help from the group at Manchester to develop a working memory, and this sort of went back and forth. And once the memory was working, it was adopted in England. I think only later did we have a lot of controversy over who was first. I mean, I think we may never decide who was first because people were cooperating at the time.
And so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And it's still a mystery. I think one of the two big mysteries are why. We were afraid the Germans were working on nuclear weapons, and it turned out they really were not getting anywhere. And likewise, computers. They had everything there. They had one of the best computer people there was in the world, Konrad Zuse, and gave very little support to the idea. I think they didn't see computation as being something that would directly affect the outcome of the war, whereas it actually abundantly did.
We're talking with George Dyson, who is the author of Turing's Cathedral, and we're going to take just a quick break and be back with a little bit more conversation in just a moment. He's appearing at Louisville Free Public Library tonight at 7 at an author event. It's Here and Now on WFPL.
Support for WFPL comes from Optique by Correct, located in Prospect, featuring handcrafted eyewear frames by British designer Tom Davis. Customers can personally create custom-made glasses from a variety of styles, colors, and materials. More at optikbycorrect.com.
Part of the story, and we're talking with George Dyson, author of Turing's Cathedral, part of the story involves John von Neumann at Princeton, the Institute for Advanced Studies.
Not at the university. Separate from the university.
Tell me that story.
That goes back to Louisville. That's Flexner. So Flexner was an incredibly innovative school teacher here in Louisville who flunked his first class entirely.
How he made his name, wasn't
it? Yeah, made a name for himself. And I'm sure here they know a lot more about Flexner than I do, but from a large family. And he went to sort of single-handedly try and reform education in the United States. He wrote a report on medical schools that led to two-thirds of the medical schools in North America being shut down for being just hopelessly bad. And then towards the end of his life, he decided to just realize his dreams, which was to create a institution where scholars could do whatever they wanted. And through a sort of miraculous series of coincidences, the Bamberger family, who had the money, came up with the money, and he built this place called the Institute for Advanced Study. And right as the things went bad in Europe, so it became a refuge for these scholars fleeing Europe who couldn't get positions in the normal American academic establishment. And I think it was a mistake, maybe. He built it in Princeton, not realizing that forever, sort of, Princeton University would get the credit, not him.
If I remember, I don't remember the quote exactly, but he wanted a place where he could bring together mathematicians, and if they wanted to talk to each other, they could. If they didn't want to talk to each other, they didn't have to, but they were all working together on various various experiments of their own, but toward one goal.
Well, they were not supposed to work on experiments. The idea was no experiments, just theoretical, pure theoretical work. And we forget, because we remember it because people like Einstein were there. So we remember the math and physics and forget that they had a very strong school in the history of art, the classical Greek history, archaeology. Benjamin Merritt was there, who sort of could be a role model for Raiders of the Lost Ark. So there was a lot going on there besides math and physics. And it was a remarkable place. I mean, I think one of the phrases wasn't actually Flexner's, but you know what could be better than to give people who can think the leisure in which to do it? So
in the modern era, as we tell the history of computers, let's say from the 70s on, which is a story we've heard a lot in the past several months with the passing of Steve Jobs.
Yes.
This is told in many different ways. Often we talk about the computers that were in industry, these massive computers, and then mini computers, and then a kind of democratizing moment that began in the 70s, but really saw its full fruition in the 90s and maybe the early part of the 2000s, where the computer became available to everyone. Is there a parallel story to that that exists decades before of a great leap forward for computing? Maybe not, it's not coming into everyone's homes, but it's taking the computer from the government and scientists and pushing it in the direction of industry. It's a breakout moment for the computer.
Yeah, the moment really was when these machines started to be replicated so that you could buy them. And at first, you know, that was a transition from a machine that you know, cost $10 million to a machine that cost $1 million. And all we've done is sort of proceed along that path with the time between generations being reduced and the cost being reduced and the speed being, it's almost inevitable from the basic architecture they started with, this idea that you have a digital address matrix, which is the part that interests me, sort of where, because that does go back to almost a single point where you put in 10 bits for an instruction and 10 bits for an address, and you get back a 40-bit number. So you put in 20, you got back 40. That was like, you know, 1 + 1 = 4. And once you started that process, nobody could stop it. It just meant that, you know, every year we're going to have more memory. We're going to have more code. The codes are going to get bigger. The memories are going to get bigger, and the machines are going to get cheaper. And we're, you know, we're living in that world now where we, as human beings, are just simply trying to keep up with all this code that is almost self-propagating.
Where will we reach the limits of those fundamentals that have been at the very basis of computing for so long?
I don't know if we will. I mean, every few years someone says, you know, wait a minute, we're reaching the limit. You know, it's next year we're going to hit some sort of physical limit. And then a year later someone comes up with some new process that escapes the limit. So, I think I have this sort of, again, being somewhat of a, from a mathematical background, to me I'd say that it's sort of inherently mathematical that this thing is going to keep expanding no matter what the hardware won't be the limit.
It seems that maybe this is something that computer scientists don't think as much about as all the rest of us do, but we have for a long time thought that there might be some day in the future where artificial intelligence would loom. And I guess, you know, all of us interpret that in different ways, and maybe I as a layperson have a much different interpretation from you. But what are your thoughts on where we are going in terms of computers that can in some way understand and intuit from the world around them?
Yes, well, that's something that Alan Turing thought about almost more than anyone else, and I think had very prophetic views. That's where the title of the book comes from. And I think we may be there sooner than we expect. I mean, my theory is if you did have a real artificial intelligence, it would be intelligent enough not to reveal itself to us. And that's, you know, that sort of adds us. That's not science fiction. That's just the reality. And we're building machines that are, you know, they're so large and distributed that we really can't necessarily understand the whole thing. I think Google is a good example where, and Alan Turing was very explicit that no real artificial intelligence would be a fully deterministic machine. The machine would have to make mistakes and guess. And in a way, that's what, you know, we think we are searching the search engines, but actually the search engines are searching us every time. The search engine has all the data and all the information, but doesn't know where the meaning is. And every time you're presented with 100 results from Google and you click on the one that's meaningful to you, that deterministic machine is learning something about where the human meaning is.
And so it is adapting as it's
very much learning from us. I mean, we are learning them. Machines are learning from us as much as we are learning from the machines. It's a symbiotic process, and I don't think you need to read anything dark into that. It's just a gaining of knowledge.
George Dyson, thank you for coming and spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
George Dyson is the author of Turing's Cathedral, The Origins of the Digital Universe. There was an article you wrote for Edge, John Brockman's site way back. We'll link that on our show notes on WFPL.org so you have a chance to read that. It'll give you a kind of sense of what he is writing in Turing's Cathedral. Some of it actually shows up at the very beginning,
right.
I think, too. So it'll give you a sense of it. Also tonight, he is appearing at the Louisville Free Public Library, an author event at 7. My guess is that it's packed to the gills in that room, but give it a shot if you can. Call the library if you want details to try to get yourself in. Here and now on WFPL.